Did you realize that your specific city block, like the exact street where you live, has a secret bank account worth millions of dollars?
Millions, yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of wild to think about.
It really is. I mean, every time you pay rent or buy groceries or even just hire a contractor to fix something, thousands of dollars are flowing right past your front door.
Right past
And
it.
usually it's going straight out of your neighborhood to, remote
Which
shareholders.
is incredibly frustrating when you actually see the numbers.
Oh, totally. But today we're doing a deep dive into a framework called Blockonomics and something called the Third Way.
Developed by Ward Strat.
Yes, exactly. And the mission of this deep dive is to really unpack this framework because it's essentially a blueprint for capturing that money flow and using it for neighborhood level economic regeneration.
And it fundamentally flips how we view the economy. I mean, we are so conditioned to think of the economy as this macroeconomic weather system.
Right, like a hurricane that just happens to us.
Exactly. We think it's driven entirely by central banks and, global supply chains and massive corporations.
You just feel so small in comparison.
We do. But this framework argues that the most potent, untapped economic engine is actually sitting right there at the human scale.
Which means it starts at the level of a single city block.
Just one block. That's all it takes to start.
Okay, so to understand why a local framework like this Third Way is even necessary, we first need to take a really hard look at the mechanics of our current system.
Yeah, we have to look at the trap we're in.
Right. And Sturat's framework refers to the current economy as a financial gravity well.
A gravity well. I love that term for this.
It's very visual, and it's built on what the sources call the Matthew principle, which is basically this idea that to those who have, more will be given.
Wealth naturally concentrates.
Yeah. It pulls more assets into its orbit like a black hole. But how exactly does a normal neighborhood get caught in that gravity well?
Well, it happens primarily through a mechanism the framework calls private taxes.
Private taxes. Okay, unpack that for me. Because when we talk about taxes, we usually mean, government taxes.
Right. And government taxes, in theory at least, pay for public goods, like roads and schools.
Sure.
But private taxes are different. They are the inescapable overhead costs imposed by concentrated capital.
So, like, what kind of costs are we talking about?
Rent extraction, interest on debt, mandatory insurance, and a big one right now is platform fees.
Oh, like delivery apps.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Every time you use an app to order food from a local restaurant down the street, a 30% private tax is siphoned straight out of your community.
And it gets sent to a tech company thousands of miles away.
Yep. It just vanishes from the local ecosystem.
And what's crucial here, according to the sources, is that this extraction doesn't account for the underlying life systems it relies on.
Not at all. Pure market capitalism is it's highly efficient at leveraging assets, but it treats things like community trust or ecological stability or even family care work as if they are infinite free resources.
Right. Like when housing becomes a speculative asset rather than just, shelter.
Yeah, you eventually reach a point where nurses and teachers literally can't afford to live in the neighborhoods they serve.
Which is something we're seeing in major cities all over the world right now.
Everywhere.
But usually, when people bring this up, the traditional response is either we need more government intervention and regulations.
Or the exact opposite.
Right, the whole let the free market sort it out argument.
Yeah.
So why do the sources say that both of those approaches have failed us?
Well, the third way diagnoses both pure markets and pure governments as failures of scale.
Failures of scale. Okay.
Yeah. Think about governments. They are hampered by massive bureaucratic inertia and short election cycles.
Right. Politicians only think about the next 2 to 4 years.
Exactly. Which makes it nearly impossible for them to plan multi-generationally.
And on the flip side, markets.
Markets optimize for quarterly extraction. They just want the next earnings report to look good. Neither system can optimize for the long-term health of a specific tangible community.
Okay, so that's exactly where the third way sits. It's not about abolishing the free market, right?
Yellen, no.
And it's not waiting around for some state socialist utopia either. It's about building a multi-generational cooperative structure right in the middle.
A parallel system, operating at a scale where people actually know each other.
And the way it measures success is just a total departure from how we usually measure economic health.
It's a completely different paradigm.
Yeah, it just abandons GDP entirely.
Good riddance, honestly.
Right? And it replaces it with something called the Lifetime Efficiency Index, or the LTE.
The LTE is just a brilliant shift in perspective because think about GDP. It simply measures the volume of money changing hands.
So if there's a terrible hurricane and we have to spend millions rebuilding destroyed homes,
GDP goes up. It looks like economic growth, but it completely ignores human well-being.
Right, but the LTE index, it doesn't measure money. It measures time.
Time. Specifically, it calculates how much of your finite working life is consumed just to cover essential survival costs.
So we're talking housing, food, energy, transport.
Yeah, basics. It treats income not just as currency, but as literal hours of your life.
Okay, so the framework contrasts two realities to really illustrate this. And this blew my mind.
The numbers are stark.
Very. In Vancouver, under the current extractive model, the LTE score hovers around 99.9%.
Wow.
But in Copenhagen, it's around 63.7%.
Let's break down what those numbers actually mean for a real human being.
Please do.
A 99.9% LTE means that virtually every single hour you spend working is eaten up by basic survival and private taxes.
You're just on a treadmill.
Exactly. You are left with a fraction of a percent of your labor value as actual surplus, but in a system with a 63% LTE.
You are literally buying back decades of your life.
Decades. That's time liberated for your family or civic engagement or, you know, simply resting.
Which we all desperately need. So the third way is designed specifically to drive that LTE number down. We want our time back.
That is the ultimate goal.
But, okay, let me play devil's advocate here. How does a group of busy neighbors actually start building this parallel economy?
It sounds daunting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't just step onto your porch and declare your street a third-way cooperative and expect your rent to magically go down.
No, the landlord won't care about your declaration.
Right. And without, like, billions in venture capital to build an app or something, how does this actually get off the ground?
It starts with something incredibly mundane, honestly. It starts with the stuff sitting unused in our garages and our closets.
So we're talking about the share pool.
The share pool, yes. Yep. That is the initial mechanism.
So pooling tools, kitchen equipment, camping gear. The sources use this classic example of a power drill.
It's the perfect example.
Yeah, because the average power drill is used for maybe 15 minutes over its entire lifespan.
15 minutes, and the rest of the time, it just sits there collecting dust.
Right, because we don't actually need to own a drill. We just need a hole in the wall.
Precisely.
Hmm.
The framework points out that we are burdened with an overabundance of physical stuff, but we suffer from a massive deficit of community connection.
That is so true. We have so much junk, but we don't know our neighbors.
Right, so when you and your neighbors create a share pool for a building or a block, you are doing two critical things.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, you are bypassing the extractive supply chain. You didn't go to a big box store and buy a brand new drill.
So that money stays in your pocket.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But the second effect is psychological, and it's much more important.
Building what the sources call democratic muscle.
Yes, democratic muscle.
I want to dig into that concept because it touches on why so many people feel completely cynical about their power to change anything these days.
We feel so powerless.
We really do. We often feel unrepped. Unrepresented.
Oh, for sure. We vote every 4 years. The politician goes off to the Capitol, puts on noise-canceling headphones, and just listens to lobbyists.
Yeah, our entire civic engagement is basically reduced to pulling a lever and just hoping for the best.
And just like biological muscle, if democratic muscle goes unused, it atrophies.
It just wastes away.
We've ceded so much of our collective decision-making to massive institutions that we've quite literally forgotten how to govern ourselves.
And so a share pool acts as physical therapy for that atrophied muscle.
That's a great way to put it. When you have to negotiate with a neighbor about how to maintain a shared lawnmower or who gets to use the camping gear this weekend.
You are practicing grassroots governance.
You are proving to yourselves that interdependent systems can actually function reliably.
Okay, so this sharing mechanism is the on-ramp.
It is.
And by participating in these share pools, like lending an item or teaching a neighbor a skill, you earn your first community credits.
Which is the currency of the third way.
Right. And this is crucial, because while sharing a ladder builds trust, goodwill alone doesn't buy the raw materials to fix the pothole.
No, it does not.
Or install a neighborhood solar array.
Yeah.
You need actual capital. So how does a community generate hard capital without just taking out a massive loan from a traditional bank?
That is the core innovation of the Blockonomics model. It's called the 33-33-33 backing formula.
The 33-33-33 formula. Okay. Walk me through exactly how this works.
Let's use an example.
Great. Let's say our block decides we want to build a community greenhouse.
I love that. Fresh tomatoes for everyone.
Exactly. And let's say it's going to cost $3,000 to buy the materials, prepare the site, and get it running.
All right, $3,000.
Under the current system, we'd have to go to a bank, take out a $3,000 loan, and pay it back with interest.
Which creates an immediate private tax on the neighborhood. The bank extracts value.
Right. So how does the third way fund it without the bank?
Well, under the 33 formula, you don't actually need $3,000 in cash.
You don't?
No. You only need one-third of the total. So just $1,000 in actual hard currency reserves.
Okay, so we scrounge up a grand. Where does the rest come from?
The rest of the project's value is capitalized by the community itself.
Mm-hmm.
So that first $1,000 is cash. The second $1,000 is backed by pledged community labor.
Okay, wait. Let me stop you there. Because the cash part makes sense. But how does pledged labor back a currency?
It's all about value creation.
But if I say, hey, I'm going to do $200 worth of carpentry on this greenhouse, and then I just, you know, don't show up, hasn't the community just printed money out of thin air that is now completely worthless?
And that's the critical difference between this system and, like, speculative fiat currency.
Okay.
Community credits aren't printed up front based on a promise.
Oh, they aren't.
No. They are issued at the point of value creation. Your $200 in community credits acts like a localized performance bond.
I see.
The neighborhood council approves the project, sure. But the credits are held in a ledger. They only enter circulation once the community actually verifies that the carpentry is finished.
So the currency is quite literally grounded in the productive capacity of the neighborhood rather than debt.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes sense. And then the final third.
The final third is shared assets.
Right. So instead of going out and renting a concrete mixer from some massive corporate hardware store,
the community utilizes a mixer that is already part of the share pool.
Essentially keeping that $1,000 of value in-house.
Precisely. It radically reduces the capital barrier to entry for neighborhood improvements.
But wait, if we are creating this new local currency, how do we ensure it actually strengthens the community? Like, how do we prevent a few people from just becoming local hoarders of community credits?
That is where the system utilizes something called demurrage.
Demurrage. Okay, explain how a local community enforces that, because it sounds like a very complex monetary policy.
It's actually a very old concept, but it's simple in practice. Demurrage simply means the currency is programmed to lose a tiny fraction of its value over time if it isn't spent.
Really? Like it just disappears?
Think of it like a digital parking meter on your money.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. If you try to hoard community credits in the local digital wallet, they might depreciate by, say, 1% a month.
So it effectively penalizes hoarding and incentivizes velocity.
It acts like a hot potato. You want to spend those credits within your community as quickly as possible.
So you buy those tomatoes from the new greenhouse, or you pay a neighbor to fix your bike.
Exactly. It forces the capital to circulate.
And as it circulates, the framework suggests residents can use it to invest in microassets.
This is huge. This shifts the goal from just, you know, shopping locally to actually owning the local infrastructure.
Which is a transition from being just a consumer to being a co-owner.
Exactly. A microasset is fractional ownership of a productive community resource.
So going back to our greenhouse, let's say it produces value, like food that reduces our grocery bills or a surplus that we sell at a farmer's market.
Because you helped build it or because you invested community credits into it, you own a fractional share.
So you could own a piece of a community solar array for like a few cents.
Literally pennies, yes.
And the dividend you receive from that micro asset isn't necessarily a cash payout, right?
No, it's usually a reduction in your essential bills.
Your energy costs go down, your food costs go down.
Which directly lowers your LTE index score.
And buys back your time.
Exactly. It all connects back to time.
Okay, but managing all of this, I mean, managing a local currency, approving projects, verifying labor, tracking fractional ownership of a solar array, that requires serious organization.
It does.
How do we govern this without just recreating the exact same bloated bureaucracy we are trying to escape from the government?
The framework handles this through a structure called nested democracy.
Nested democracy. And this relies on citizen circles and super blocks,
yeah.
Right? Okay, so a super block is a cluster of roughly 10 city blocks covering about 1,000 residents.
Yeah, around 1,000 people. And that number is intentional.
Why 1,000?
It's large enough to sustain a diverse local exchange. Like, You have enough people to find childcare or specialized skills or a good variety of tools in the share pool.
But it's not too big.
Right. It is small enough to avoid anonymity. You still kind of recognize faces.
Okay. And the governance scales from the bottom up.
Always bottom up. So 50 households might form a baseline citizen circle.
And they make decisions about their specific street.
Right. But if a project affects a wider area, representatives from those smaller circles escalate it to the super block level.
It's the principle of proximity to consequence.
Exactly. I love that phrase. The people who actually have to look at the greenhouse or listen to the noise of the solar installation are the ones making the decision.
So if the city government says no to funding a new park, the super block can just leverage its own 33 formula and build it anyway.
They don't have to wait for permission. They have the democratic muscle, the organizational structure, and the labor.
But, and there is a big but here, as we discussed, they still need that one-third in hard cash reserves to kickstart these projects.
They do need that initial seed money.
And in a high LTE economy where everyone is just living paycheck to paycheck, asking neighbors to pony up thousands of dollars seems basically impossible.
It sounds like a non-starter, but it's not.
Which brings us back to the hook we started with at the top of the show, the secret bank account.
The hidden wealth.
Where does that initial cash come from? Because the Blockonomics framework mapped out all 5,806 blocks in Vancouver.
They did a massive data analysis.
They crunched the aggregate income and spending data, and they found that the average Vancouver city block has a latent annual budget of $2.4
million. $2.4
million.
It's just a staggering figure when you realize that money is generated by just 100 or so ordinary people living their lives.
But they don't experience that wealth at all?
No, of course not. They don't have $2.4 million sitting in a local credit union.
And that's because of the leakage rate.
The leakage rate. Almost all of that $2.4 million is immediately extracted.
Right. It pays the absentee landlord, the international energy conglomerate, the telecom monopoly, the massive grocery chain.
It hits the block and just immediately drains out. Like water through a sieve.
But the strategy of the third way isn't to try and capture all 2.4 million.
No, you don't need a total revolution. That's the beauty of it.
The framework advocates for something called the 5% redirect.
Just 5%.
If a block of residents consciously decides to redirect just 5% of their existing annual spending into this local third way system, it completely changes the math.
Because 5% of $2.4 million is $120,000.
That is a lot of seed money.
It is. That is $120,000 of hard currency that no longer leaks out of the neighborhood.
And when you inject that cash into a local system governed by community credits and share pools, it doesn't just sit there in a vault.
No, it triggers the local multiplier effect.
Okay, explain how exactly that math works. Because the framework calculates a 2.6 times multiplier. How does redirecting $120,000 act like over $300,000?
It's all about the velocity of money within a closed loop.
Okay.
If you spend a dollar at a massive chain supermarket, roughly 80 cents of that dollar leaves your community that exact same day.
The leakage is basically instant.
But if you redirect that dollar into your super block, say you pay a neighbor for vegetables from a microasset garden.
Okay, now that neighbor has my dollar.
Exactly. They have a dollar. And they use it to pay the local handyman to fix their front steps.
And then the handyman uses it to buy coffee from the local roaster.
Yes. And because the community credits have demurrage, that hot potato effect, they are heavily incentivized to keep spending it locally.
Wow. So that single dollar changes hands multiple times before it finally leaks out to pay for something the neighborhood just can't produce itself, like a internet infrastructure.
Right. The 2.6 multiplier means that every dollar kept local does the economic work of nearly $3.
That is incredible.
You are strengthening the block's collective balance sheet without needing anyone to take on a second job.
Or secure a bank loan.
You are simply plugging the leak.
It's taking invisible, scattered spending power and turning it into a tangible fortress of community wealth.
And if we follow this thread all the way to its logical conclusion, we return right back to the LTE index.
Right. Time.
Everything in the third way points back to the LTE. The entire purpose of organizing share pools, issuing community credits, building micro assets, and plugging the leakage rate.
It isn't to make everyone in the neighborhood a millionaire.
No. The goal is to systematically lower the essential cost of living for the people on that block.
So by pooling resources and keeping capital local, you don't have to work 50 hours a week just to pay private taxes to remote shareholders.
The 2.6 multiplier ensures that local investments yield a massive return in time saved.
You are quite literally buying back years of your life, liberating those hours for your family, your passions, or your community.
It proves that economic agency doesn't require waiting for federal policy shifts or, you know, hoping for global market corrections.
A neighborhood already has the capital, the labor, and the assets present.
The third way just provides the blueprint to interlock them.
This has been such a fascinating deep dive. Let's look at the arc of what we've covered today.
We've covered a lot.
We really did. We started with the harsh reality of the extractive system, that financial gravity well that drains our finite life hours through inescapable private taxes.
And then we saw how the simple, almost radical act of sharing a power drill acts as physical therapy for our atrophied democratic muscle.
Right. We explored how that newfound trust scales up through the 33 backing formula, allowing communities to leverage their own labor and assets to back a local currency.
And how mechanisms like demurrage and fractional microassets ensure that the capital actually serves the neighborhood rather than a few hoarders.
And finally, we looked at the sheer mathematical power of the 5% redirect. That out of the $2.4 million flowing down your street every year, capturing just a tiny fraction of it creates a compounding multiplier effect.
An effect that stops the leakage and drives down your essential cost of living.
It's a compelling argument from Sturat that the power to reshape our economic reality doesn't reside in distant capitals.
It resides in the physical space we occupy every single day.
Which brings us to a final thought for you to mull over as you go about your day.
Something to explore on your own.
Exactly. We've talked entirely about physical assets today. Drills, greenhouses, solar panels. But think about the digital realm.
Oh, that's an interesting pivot.
Right. Your block generates an immense amount of local data every single day. Traffic patterns, purchasing habits, energy usage. And right now, massive tech platforms extract all of that data for free and monetize it.
100% leakage rate.
100%. So what if the principles of the third way and the share pool were applied to your digital footprint? Could a super block form a local data trust, collectively bargaining with tech companies to capture the value of the information you are already generating?
That is a wild thought.
It's just something to consider. The resources are already there, whether physical or digital. The only question left is who is going to be the first to knock on a door and start the conversation.